coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Rachel Dolezal put in a lot of legwork for black people. She taught African-American studies. Right, right. She's raising black children. True. She even works for the NAACP. I never did that.
Identity politics slices and dices people by race, gender, class, religion, sexual orientation.
Is it any wonder that Americans are so divided and at odds with one another?
There is not a black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America.
We're one, but we're not the same. We get to carry each other, carry each other.
Should we embrace or reject the politics of identity?
Isn't what unites us more important than what divides us?
Why can't we all just get along?
Our guest is Tommy Shelby from Harvard University.
Identity politics, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus. That's where Ken teaches philosophy, and I did for 40 years.
40 memorable years, I hope, John. Now today, we're thinking about identity politics.
That's when people of a particular race, ethnicity, gender, or religion form political alliances and organize to defend their group's interests.
You know, John, for my taste, we got way too much identity politics going on. All it does is deepen political divides. We got black versus white, straight versus gay, Jew versus Arab, Sunni versus Shia, and on and on. And it's enough already. Can't we all just get along? Can't we focus on our common humanity and not on our differences?
Well, not as long as our common humanity has led to some people being marginalized, victimized, oppressed because of their identities of who they are, what color they are. We need identity politics. How else are we going to combat the systematic killing of young black men, or homophobia, or sexism, or patriarchy, except through movements like Black Lives Matter, the gay rights movement, or women's movements?
Well, yeah, but John, we've got to transcend our divisive identities and not wallow in them if we want to get beyond them. That's the key. Transcending identity is the key to combating oppression.
Haven't you read your Hannah Arendt? One can resist oppression, she said, only in terms set by the oppressor. She dismisses the idea that the oppressed can escape their oppressions by denying their identities as the stuff of, and I quote, cloud cuckoo land.
Cloud cuckoo land. Now, that's quite a phrase. But look, I still think that this obsession with identity politics is a recipe for endless struggle and division. I just came back from a really eye-opening trip to Palestine and Israel. There, identity politics rules the day. But, you know, there's never going to be peace in that troubled region until the people there transcend their narrow identities and embrace their common humanity.
Look, Ken, if I could wave a magic wand and make all identity-based oppression and political conflict go away, I would. But that ain't how the world works.
Are you trying to tell me, then, that we're just stuck with, like, a Middle East where people with entrenched religious identities and an enduring sense of victimhood fight it out till the end of time? That sounds so depressing, so bleak, so hopeless, John.
Well, it's not as hopeless as you think. Protestants and Catholics used to beat each other's throats. Think of the, you know, wars of centuries ago. Now they're at peace all over Europe. Even in Northern Ireland, things are getting along without violence.
No, but that's not any thanks to identity politics. Identity politics was the source of the problem. It wasn't the solution. And look, and Europe, I love Europe, but think of what's going to happen to Europe in the post-Brexit world. Another example of identity politics gone amok. All those right-wing nationalistic movements sprouting all over Europe. You think that's going to lead to something good?
You're thinking of Brexit as a example of identity politics. That's a stretch, Kim.
No. Nationalism is one of the worst forms of identity politics. It's based on a shared national identity, whatever that is.
Well, maybe that's a special insight of Ken Taylor, but it's not what most people think of as identity politics. They got movements that fight for the rights of those who are historically oppressed or marginalized because they have something more or less in common, like being black or being a woman.
But how, I don't know how much there really is in common between different black people. For example, take me. I'm a black guy, but I work at an elite university. I live in a nice house in a safe neighborhood. I have a very privileged life. Compare me to a poor, marginalized black woman who's a single mother working three low-paying jobs. She's got problems that I can only imagine. It's not our blackness that gives me sympathy for her. It's our shared humanity. Shared humanity is the thing that's essential.
Well, shared humanity may be what's essential. Maybe these identities aren't based on essential commonalities, but on patterns of shared history and shared experience. More or less what Wittgenstein called family resemblances. In spite of your privileges, you have a lot in common with that black woman, I'll bet. More than you might think.
But I'm asking the question of whether that black woman, I imagine, wouldn't be better served not by black solidarity, but by a strong labor movement that fought for higher wages and improved her material conditions. A strong labor movement that was independent of race and all that stuff. What does she gain, really? What does she gain from solidarity with a privileged black guy like me?
Well, we all gain from any relation we have with you, Ken. Except for this kind of either-or thinking that infects a lot of your thought. Sure, a strong labor movement might improve her lot in life, but that doesn't mean black solidarity. People out protesting the police killing black children. I mean, I'm sure she's all for that. Black solidarity has much to offer her, too.
Well, look, it's a complicated thing. I'm not entirely convinced. And here's another reason. This notion of identity is actually fraught with problems. What if you have more than one identity? And what if those multiple identities are in conflict with one another? What do you do then, John?
Well, beats me, but we sent our roving philosophical reporter Shuka Kalantari out to speak with a woman who juggles many different identities, and she files this report.
Shared identity brings people together. They fight for change, for social justice. After the death of over 50 people in a gay bar in Orlando in 2016, the LGBT community came out to support and honor the victims. In the Black Lives Matter movement, black Americans united to fight against institutionalized racism. Then there's religious identity. Catholics go to church together. Buddhists meditate together. Muslims look towards Mecca and pray when they hear this music.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
But sometimes identities can overlap. Take the case of Red Summer. She's Muslim and black and a lesbian.
I was married to a Muslim minister, and I didn't know a lot about the world. I didn't know much about my identity, but I knew that I just wasn't, it's like something wasn't right.
Summer left the mosque the same year she left her husband. She had met a woman. She moved from Chicago to Atlanta, which had a much larger black LGBT community. But she wasn't able to fit in, especially when she mentioned she was Muslim.
When I would express some of my upbringing to people, I would have a lot of, like, my really, you know, strong feminist friends. It's like, oh my gosh, like, you've been oppressed, you've been, like, held down. And I didn't really feel that way.
Summer couldn't be a part of the Islamic community in Atlanta because she didn't feel comfortable being an out lesbian among other Muslims.
I felt like I was really living this double life and, like, in the closet in both of them. And it just felt inauthentic in both.
Summer says using identity in politics can be productive. Just look at the fight for gay marriage. But even that can be polarizing.
I was standing outside of the White House, and my fiancé and I at the time were celebrating, and we were so excited. And we were kind of faced with the people that were around us not looking like us. They were white men, and often affluent white men. So if you are a poor black woman, like, how much of that story or that struggle includes you as well?
Summer says many of her LGBT allies are against her being aligned with Islam. while many of her Islamic friends see homosexuality as a sin. And many of her black friends don't trust her Muslim friends. Eventually, Summer decided it was time to find people who completely shared her identity.
I was like, you know, let me find a group of Muslim lesbian women who are black. Like, this is Atlanta. I should be able to find a lot of them.
It wasn't easy, but Summer did find a small handful of other women just like her.
6 or 7 women who I can have a conversation with and be absolutely authentic or not be an oddity. You know, it's not that every other community is against me, but sometimes you just want to be understood and not have to explain.
Summer says it's natural for people to want to have community. But when community leads to ostracizing others, it's time to reassess our goals.
In order to be for something, then people feel that you have to be against something else. And once you pick a side, then you have allies and you have adversaries.
Rhett Summer says shared identity does bring people together, but it can also leave people out, especially if you're a black, lesbian, Muslim woman. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thank you, Shuka, and thank you, Summer, for helping us understand the complexities of identity and community. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today, we're thinking about identity politics. We're joined now by Tommy Shelby. He's a professor of philosophy and of African and African-American studies at Harvard University, the Stanford of the East, we call it. He's author of We Who Are Dark, The Philosophical Foundations of Black Solidarity. Tommy, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Wonderful to be on with you guys.
Hi, Tommy. Now, look, you've written extensively about the history and philosophy of the Black Solidarity Movement, and you know all about African and African-American history and everything. But you're also more interested in identity politics more generally. How did that happen?
Well, I suppose that it partly happened when I was an undergraduate at Florida A&M University, historically black college in Tallahassee. And these kinds of questions just are in the air. And people are constantly thinking about questions of race and gender and class and region and many other things. And I suppose that it was those sort of dorm room conversations that first got me thinking about these matters.
So much good happens in dorm room conversations. Earlier, at least a lot of philosophers come out of them, earlier Ken and I disagreed about whether we should be embracing or rejecting identity politics. Ken piously hoped that we could all just embrace our common humanity rather than amplifying our differences. What do you think about that?
Well, in some ways it sounds great, you know, and maybe in a more just cosmopolitan world we could do something like that. Though I do think that, you know, identities are at least among the resources that we rely on when we're trying to make sense of our lives and we're trying to, you know, forge, you know, bonds with other people or trying to carry out various joint actions. In those cases, I think our identities are, you know, similar to a kind of cultural practice, and inevitably they're going to revolve around, you know, difference rather than common humanity.
No, I you know, I'm all for identity, and I don't reject my identity. I have multiple identities. I embrace them. But it's not so much identity that's the problem. It's identity politics. I mean, I have to admit, I'm a kind of a wimpy, humanity-loving guy. I find myself having broad sympathies for people. I have sympathies across racial lines, across class lines, across national lines. I care. I'm a lefty, but I care about free trade because I care about the poor around the world, and I think trade properly done ameliorates the plight of the poor around the world.
We'll stipulate you're a great guy.
No, so why should my sympathies though and my allegiances be focused around more narrow elements of my identity rather than more fundamental, like one human among others?
Well, they probably shouldn't be. I mean, in some ways, I think the talk of identity politics is something that critics, you know, it's a category almost that critics use to sort of cast aspersions on certain forms of politics they don't like. But I think, you know, often what you have are not so much emphasis on identity, but an emphasis on, you know, social groups that are, you know, marginalized, you know, mistreated, living under very unjust conditions. And I think sometimes just as a matter of political realism, it makes sense for them to build movements, bonds of solidarity, political organizations, in order to advocate some of those kind of more lofty ideals that you're speaking about.
Yeah, but it seems to me most of the times that the identity politics movements do grow out of some kind of oppression. Like take me. I'm a Nebraskan. Big deal. How often do I think about that? Not very often. But if there began to be in California some kind of systematic oppression of Nebraskans, Nebraska jokes, signs appearing outside of clubs, no dull people or Nebraskans admitted, I would find my Nebraska identity asserting itself. I might be marching or shouting or at least tweeting.
I would certainly expect that you would. Right? I mean, once the identity becomes salient as a basis for mistreatment, then it would be natural to seek out others who are, have a similar plight. I think partly because of trust. There's a question of, who you feel like you can really rely on, and those who have a common stake in the outcome of some political conflict will naturally look to each other as people that they think they might be able to trust.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about identity politics.
Do you think identity politics serves a useful purpose? Or does it just create deeper divisions among us? Should the ultimate goal of identity politics to see different identities wither away?
Politics, Identity, and Difference, when Philosophy Talk continues.
To you, it's only for a week, so have no fear. Be grateful that it doesn't last all year.
Tom Lehrer, kind of consolidating the wisdom of ages into a few deaf notes. Protestant, Catholic, Muslim, Hindu, how should differences in identity influence our politics? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
With one major exception. That would be your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're thinking about identity politics.
Our guest is Tommy Shelby from Harvard University. He's the author of We Who Are Dark, The Philosophical Foundations of Black Solidarity.
So you and John seemed both, in the last little exchange we had, you and John both seemed to agree essentially with Hannah Arendt. She says you can't fight the oppressor except in terms set by the oppressor. She was worrying about what she, as a cosmopolitan internationalist Jew, should think about Hitler and the Holocaust. She has to declare her allegiance to the oppressed people. But here's a little, I see the point, but doesn't the oppressor win when that happens? If the oppressor is allowed to throw on an identity on you and that marginalize you, and you have to accept that in order to combat it, doesn't the oppressor win?
Well, you don't have to accept the oppressor's conception of the group's sense of self, right? I mean, it might be that the group has a very different self-understanding, and in terms of their own aspiration, the members of the group's own aspirations, that they diverge quite radically from what the oppressor has in mind.
Right. So you don't contest the terms, but that means it sounds like you're saying you contest the meaning of the terms. So Arendt didn't go far enough, right? Because Hitler doesn't get to say, or the white man doesn't get to say, the slaveholders doesn't get to say what blackness means. That's for us somehow to declare. Is that?
I think that's right. Though, of course, there are words there, too. I mean, one can feel, disciplined and oppressed by, say, a dominant conception of who we are. And so you want to make sure your pluralism goes all the way down, right? I mean, you want to make sure that, within the group there isn't a lot of pressure to conform to, say, some preferred conception of, say, being a man or a woman or being black or being gay or so on.
So let me ask you about the long term, because there's another thing that you, Arendt, and John seem to agree on, right? Because you said it's the oppression in terms of these identities that necessitates or justifies or something identity politics. What happens when the oppression goes away, right? Should the aim of identity politics be to make identity not matter, so that in the end it's like an instrument for achieving a kind of cosmopolitan solidarity, or is it something more permanent and fixed or something?
That's interesting. I mean, I think maybe this is one of those cases where philosophers' tendency to abstract and talk about identity in general can lead us astray. I mean, and if you compare identity politics to the kind of class-based politics that some socialist Marxists, for instance, had in mind, then it certainly has that character, right? It's the ideas that, well, you organize around being a wage laborer, and by doing so, you're able to overcome economic exploitation and eventually abolish class as a kind of social position altogether. And so one wouldn't then be identifying as a member of the working class or anything like that, because class would be abolished. It's not clear to me that with other forms of group-based mobilization that it makes sense to think of yourself as abolishing the social category itself. Or as a kind of identity, as a kind of shared sense of affinity, but you're simply trying to abolish the conditions where it will be necessary to politically mobilize around that identity, not to find and not abolishing all sense of meaning that might be attached to it.
Well, I mean, nowadays, historically, groups of immigrants have been oppressed and prejudiced against them in America, the Irish, my ancestors, the Italians, and so forth. And as oppression has, I think, by and large, drifted away, the identity hasn't gone away. Now, maybe with intermarriage and so forth, eventually it will. People still think of themselves as Italian, having an Italian heritage or Irish heritage, but they don't, and they may celebrate Columbus Day, but they don't necessarily, in most of America, feel oppressed. So I think the key is getting rid of the oppression, and then whatever happens to the identity happens.
Yeah, but it sounds like you both are saying that the significance, the lived significance of the identity under oppression, right? And because then under oppression, the identity is a politically mobilizing thing. And then if we succeed in overcoming the oppression, the identity-based oppression, the lived significance of the identity may be radically different. So it's not like the Marxist elimination, but it is the kind of, I don't know, I'm going to make up a term, denuding or diminishing of the lived significance of the identity. I mean, is that a fair characterization of what you think, Tommy? I don't mean to put thoughts in your head.
Sure, that sounds fair. But of course, with some of these struggles, they've been going on for a really long time. So in the case of Black politics, I mean, you could imagine this as an intergenerational collective struggle going back since slavery. And, you know, over that time, practices have evolved with that social movement, if you like. And some of those practices are intrinsically valuable, you know, modes of expression, ways of thinking about the arts, and so on. And these things are things that people might embrace. And they might even embrace them because they see them as a way of honoring those who came before them and fought hard to make it the case that they no longer needed to mobilize around blackness.
Do you think it's possible for there to be something akin among whites, a white solidarity and appreciation movement that wasn't inherently objectionable and racist?
Well, that's a hard one. I suppose that you could run it analogously to what I just said, right? I mean, insofar as whites were engaged in a broad-based, you know, anti-racist project, embracing the abolition of white supremacy and see themselves as jointly engaged in a project to bring about that world, why couldn't they take pride in having participated in such a thing or having ancestors that brought about the post-racial utopia.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about identity politics with Tommy Shelby from Harvard University. David from Tiburon is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, David. What's
Thank
your
you.
Better question?
Hi. I think the conversation is using a term. It needs to shift. Identity politics, identity, it's really tribalism. And we can trace tribalism as far back as you want to, even to Africa and slavery, where one tribe sold the other into slavery. And in fact, I've forgotten the name of the film having to do with an uprising of the black slaves on a ship who came into the U.S. and were accused of mutiny. were found not guilty. They went back to Africa and became slave traders themselves. All over Europe, we're looking at tribalism. The breakup of the EU is because of tribalism, not identity. Politics has nothing to do with politics. It's this issue of, and then it's tribal.
David, well, thanks for the call. John, you wanted to get it.
Well, I got a good point about tribalism. The inference has nothing to do with politics.
Yeah.
I doubt. But
Tommy, you got a thought
point
for us here on tribalism? Is identity politics just a form of tribalism? Is it a misnomer to call it identity politics and not tribalism? I mean, what's your thought on the welter of things David threw at us?
Well, that could be, you know, good and bad, identity politics, right? So, maybe part of what's going on here is, if you think of identity politics as just a matter of the members of some group advancing their interest, so the whole point of it is just to advance their interest, then, yeah, you're going to run into these kinds of problems. But I think a lot of people who are engaged in identity politics, you know, they see themselves engaged in a moral project or a project that's undergirded by moral concerns, right? So in that case, I think some of these worries can be allayed because, you know, they're going to be thinking about justice is going to be guiding them, not just the interest of the group.
I think you're getting a point that's really deep, and I just want to dwell on it for a little bit. Mm-hmm. Because I think there's a lot of people who are inclined to dismiss identity politics, and partly because they think we live in a moment where, you know, all the past disputes and division and antagonisms are somehow overcome and we could all just be one big happy family. But the world is not like that, even though I was sort of saying that in the, that was sort of the setup of frame of reference. But the world is not like that. And I want to just focus, like, not on America, but say the Palestinians and the Israelis. I mean, there's a very complicated thing. The Holocaust was a horrible event, but one of the things it did is reconstituted a kind of Jewish solidarity. Jews were a very divided people. Some were assimilationists, some deep old-fashioned religion. The Zionists wanted to escape from that old-fashioned. I mean, it was a fractured community, and it was a destroyed community, and it reconstituted itself through this commitment of this joint project of building Israel. But there's something else that the Zionists did when they came to the shores of the Middle East. They gave rise to the Palestinian identity. I mean, they gave rise to Palestinian nationalism, and these things were kind of born in deep conflict with each other. They both have these grievances. They have this historical struggle. I mean, this is not simple stuff. It's not stuff, I'm just saying, it's not stuff that you can easily throw off, and it is tied up with deep aspirations of humans to decent treatment and respect and all that stuff.
But I think David makes a good point, is to see all of these things, complex as they are and the modern overtones as they are, as going back to, you know, what's basic, not just among humans, but among mammals. I mean, what's important is not historically, it's not the common humanity, but the difference in family or the difference in tribe. And then it just gets larger and larger and has more and more overtones. And you say, oh, no, we're not just different tribes. We think you have to be immersed to be baptized, and they don't. So let's kill them. But to see it in this evolutionary perspective, I think, is helpful in diminishing the gravitas we attach to current debates.
What do you think about it, Tommy?
Well, I think that's all sounds right. I think we're getting closer to agreement on some of these issues. I mean, maybe a lot of this would be helped if we just figure, what are we contrasting identity politics with? I mean, what would the alternative be? I mean, I suppose maybe some people think it should be, you know, political ideology or, you know, just common objectives, setting aside any, you know, ideological differences, identity differences. But I think in a lot of these cases where we're talking about the members of an oppressed group, I think they can, part of their identity politics is informed by political ideology and is informed by common objectives or a sense of what their common objectives are. So I think in some ways it's these are kind of false contrasts between what can be a basis for collective political action.
Steve from San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Steve.
Hi there. I'd just like to say that I don't think multiple identity allegiances or identification is necessarily mutually exclusive. In my case, I have a number of them, and they all seem to work together really well. I'm a gay, white male with dual citizenship, Canadian and United States, I have a professional background, and all these different aspects of myself help me have a good overview of things, and not just one specific area, but they complement my entire life and seeing things in a holistic way.
So it sounds like you think the more identities, the merrier, Steve. Is that right?
Well, whatever works for you. I mean, I don't think you should deny it. I think it can be kept in balance with the larger overview of the community or the society that we live in, with multiple peoples and multiple identities. But I don't. If anything, I think they can help strengthen your understanding and perception, because you can see the diversity as well as the unity.
So thanks for the call, Steve. So tell me, what do you want to respond to Steve in any way?
Well, I think he's certainly right. I mean, that we don't have one identity, right? We have multiple social identities. It seems weird to think of them as conflicting. I think we're using these social identities as a kind of resources to fashion a sense of self, right? To fashion a kind of self-understanding, a way to navigate
but they
the
don't
world.
All sit. Go back to Summer. Right. Or my friend Fred, who was a gay Catholic and tried to, when the Catholic Church was very repressive toward it, and he wrote a whole book about it. It was called Becoming Michael, how he could both be gay and Catholic. And it was a big struggle for him. So they do sometimes. I mean,
well, I think what's conflicting there is not so much the identity, but the forms of affiliation. Right. So, you have an identity that you're fashioning for yourself, and it's multiple in these ways, but you're also trying to cultivate a sense of community with others who share those identities. And I think the conflict arises where, often when, because you're trying to affiliate with more than one group, and those groups might have different objectives, different aims.
So I'm not quite sure. Is there a way to manage? I'm not quite sure what you're saying there. I'm not quite sure what follows. I mean, I wonder about an incoherent self, right? Whether myself can be made coherent and be true to all the things that tug me.
So are you think that those of us with incoherent selves are somehow inferior and should be treated differently?
So, I mean, is the self bound to be coherent? Is it really bound that I can reconcile these things?
Well, we're probably never fully make it coherent, right? It's more aspirational, I think. I mean, we're trying to fashion something that's coherent, that makes sense to us. And, there are cases where it'd be clearly incoherent. It's kind of hard to be a Christian and an atheist. But there are in other cases, I think, you find a tension there and you try to work through it. And maybe you never really fully work it out until it's completely smooth.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about identity politics with Tommy Shelby from Harvard University.
Do you have several different identities? Do they all sit comfortably together? Or do they ever conflict with one another? How do you negotiate the politics of your various conflicting identities?
Reconciling conflicting identities when Philosophy Talk continues.
Brother, we can't quit until we get our share.
Getting down with James Brown. Proud to be black or Muslim or gay, but what happens when those identities come into conflict? Political conflict, some other kind of conflict. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Tommy Shelby from Harvard University. We're thinking about identity politics, and we're joined by Lydia, who's on the line from El Cerrito. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Lydia. What's your comment?
Oh, thank you very much. Well, this subject of reconciling conflicting identities is very dear to my heart. Many people who know me also know that I am from Hawaii. And so what that really means is that I'm a product of many different ethnic groups that have come together. And I'm also part Hawaiian. So one of the difficulties I have is that it's difficult for me to be anyone else except the person that I happen to be at this moment, because when I try to affiliate myself with a particular identity, yes, I identify more with being Hawaiian at times, and then I also identify more with being Chinese, or I identify more with being Scottish, you know what I mean? So it's kind of difficult, especially in Hawaii, where they have this movement now, where they have a solidarity movement. And I find that there's a kind of a reverse racism, which really troubles me when I go back to my islands, because it's like everybody wants to know what percentage of Hawaiian you are. And yeah. that determines, you know, your value in that particular culture, the Hawaiian, Native Hawaiian culture. On the other hand, I also find that people who are transplants, who say come from Michigan, not that there's anything wrong with Michigan, but you know what I mean, they're not Native Hawaiians,
yeah,
but because they live there, they call themselves Hawaiians, thinking
right.
like, if you live in Texas, you're a Texan.
I got you, Lydia. So look, my wife's from Hawaii, so I know well what you speak of. I want to thank
yeah.
you. I want to thank you for the call, but I want to put a question based on your comments to Tommy, because I think it was implicit in her question. There are these people within every affiliation group, identity group, who claim to be the arbiters of that identity, who claim to sort of set the normative standards, who declare what's authentic or inauthentic within that group. That always bugs me, right? Because I think people, blackness is whatever the totality of black people together say it is, and it's whatever Hawaiianness, native, it's whatever the totality. And but there are these people, the elites within that, who claim to be the arbiters. What do you think about that thought?
Well, it's certainly a deep tendency in, I think, these forms of politics, and it's something to be resisted. I mean, in some ways, what we want to get free of is the pressures to assimilate that are happening outside the group and the pressures that are happening within it, right? So there might be, you might have your preferred way of being black or being gay or being Christian or whatnot, and you should be free to pursue that, provided it doesn't, harm others, not incompatible with a just society and whatnot. But there are always going to be some people who are going to be pressing for their preferred conception of identity to be the dominant one and wanting others to conform to it. But I think that's something that needs to be resisted.
There's a thing that I think is under-theorized. So you were talking about identity politics, and we're thinking about the way groups form solidarity affiliations to achieve political aims and liberationist aims. But I think maybe I just out of touch with that. I think it's under theorized how these group identities form and propagate and take hold and the variation among them. I know you've written a lot about like thin blackness as opposed to thick blackness, but it seems to me an area that's kind of not well theorized. Am I right or am I just uninformed?
Well, I think that some black feminist theorists have been working hard to try to theorize it. They usually use the label intersectionality to
right.
think about it. And they often think that there are disagreements, but I think broadly you could say they're looking for a framework for understanding group-based oppression, and they want a framework that, can acknowledge that these various forms of oppression, sexism, racism, class exploitation, so on, that they're interconnected and they kind of shape each other. And they also want us to be mindful of the fact that any one site, say, of oppression, there are going to be some members in the group who are relatively privileged and some who are more disadvantaged. And so any kind of identity politics is going to occur at some site of oppression, whether race or class or gender or whatnot. It's got to be mindful of the interconnection between these and the ways in which people are differently situated with respect to those. And I think that's probably, engagement with intersectionality theory is probably where most of the action is in addressing this problem.
So we've got some interesting email from Selena. As many kinds of oppression come into public awareness, it can create and foster new forms of oppression. As we keep hearing more and more about white oppression, it can turn into acceptable victimization of a white blonde woman such as me. I feel that may be one underlying reason why I'm unable to find resources to help my own unique oppressed situation. So that's an interesting perspective. What do you think of that?
Well, it seems obviously, even the members of a dominant group can be mistreated and
yeah.
mistreated on bad grounds. Maybe a little bit of a stretch to
think of. It's a stretch when Donald Trump says he can identify with the Black Lives Matter protesters because he's had various forms of red tape in his life.
Yeah, but you know there is a rise of white identity politics in America, and I think around the world. And it's not so much that people feel oppressed exactly, but they feel as though they feel a loss of something.
Yeah.
You know, take my country back. The country that was mine, in which I could be the uncontested through no consent from me, has been taken over by the other. And I'm irreconciled with the other. And that's a kind of identity politics. Right. It's not born of oppression, but it is born of a sense of loss and grievance. Is that illegitimate? Is that less legitimate than... Why? What's the basis of its lack?
I think Selena, I'm not even sure, fits that. I think she's just sounds like she would be a stereotypical white stereotype. White blonde woman. There's blonde jokes. There's the idea of a ditz is a stereotypical blonde white woman. It must get old. I mean, I'm speaking as a white man who really has never felt very oppressed by that at all.
So what do you think, Tommy? I mean, I think it's complicated, the sources of the urge to identity politics. I'm not saying all urges are equally legitimate, but there are many sources of this urge.
Yeah, I think there are. And I mean, one hesitates to go to social psychology when you're engaged in these things. But I mean, I think clearly a lot of people might be moved toward some of these forms of white working class identity politics. Out of economic insecurity and a sense that, you know, they can't achieve the things that their ancestors were able to achieve, say, with limited education, and things have changed. So I wouldn't want to say, I mean, so some of it I think is out of that, and maybe some of it is out of a sense of loss of no longer being the dominant group in a society where, that dominance being threatened. But I think a lot of it is just a kind of shared economic insecurity that many people feel, not just whites.
So combining our last two questions, I mean, the people who set themselves up as authorities of how much African American ancestry you have to have to count as African American are often, or this group or that, are often not in that group. For example, with Elizabeth Warren, Scott Walker and Donald Trump have decided that she's not Indian enough to call herself partially Native American. I think that's so peculiar. Why would rich white people worry about whether people are claiming to be Native Americans without enough Native American blood? They must somehow have the idea that there's some great advantage in that.
Yeah, they do. It's a belief that there's a culture of victimization. And if you get the status of a victim, you have an advantage in a kind of perverse way. And so this is a cherished status to this way of thinking, and you can't have it for free. I mean, one of the things wrong with the Israelis and the Palestinians is they both claim to be victims, and they both want that status, and it plays an important role in their interactions with one another. But Tommy, I want to know your thoughts on this too.
I think that's right. That can be at work, but I mean, sometimes we can lose sight of the fact in focusing on identity that the identities track other things that matter to people, power and resources and status, and often those are the things that are really at stake. And we're fighting over power and resources, but using the tools of identity or thinking in terms of identity, and it can be misleading about what's really at stake. I mean, even in the case of Elizabeth Warren, the attacks on her, Native American background, I think probably have to do with access to opportunities, a sense that, well, maybe she was able to advance herself and, through affirmative action or something like that. When other people feel threatened, they don't have those same opportunities.
You know, there. I think we're just getting to the beginning. there's so much that I want to talk to you about, because I think this is such an enormously rich and complicated subject matter. I mean, I wonder, for example, if there are irreconcilable identities, not within a person, but between people. I despair, for example, that the Palestinians and the Israelis might have an irreconcilable conflict because their ground level projects that arise from their identities can't be reconciled. Pluralism would say, no, you can reconcile anything. Do you think there's hope? Can we overcome this stuff or not? I mean, what's your last closing thought on how bleak I should feel?
Well, I mean, I think to return to the point I just made before, even in the case of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, I mean, you might – one way of casting that is as a kind of cultural identity conflict, and another way of casting it is over land and control over land. And so, I mean, those kinds of things are the substance of political conflict. And, you know, I'd like to think that these are the kinds of things that we can overcome eventually.
Yeah. So on that note, Tommy, I'm going to thank you for joining us. This has been a great conversation, and you've been a great guest, and I'm really pleased you joined us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Our guest has been Tommy Shelby. He's a professor of philosophy and of African and African-American studies at Harvard University. He's author of We Who Are Dark, The Philosophical Foundations of Black Solidarity. John, you got one last quick closing thought?
Things are complicated, but sometimes not as complicated as they seem. I really think we were very close to Palestinian and Israeli. Big step forward at the end of the Clinton administration. All came down to whether the Palestinians could have a road from Gaza to the other parts of Palestine. And then it's just gone downhill since then.
Yeah, I think it's deeper than that. I mean, I get your point, but I do think there may be ground level projects, the Jewish state, the Palestinian national aspirations that humans have that are just cannot be reconciled. That's a depressing thought. But this conversation, uplifting conversation, continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is, get this, cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you too, little old you, can become a partner in that community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And you can follow us on Twitter too. You can follow Donald Trump, you can follow Beyonce, and you can follow Philosophy Talk. We're at Phil Talk Radio. Now, here's a guy who wears his fast-talking identity on his sleeve. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, one of the biggest transgender fears the media say we have is the fear that drunk, bearded men, now calling themselves women, will barge into girls' restrooms and, I don't know, then what? There's a moral panic around transgender people. I don't know why. Just get unisex bathrooms with doors that lock. Get more bathrooms with stalls. Avert your eyes. That's what I do when I'm urinating beside men. And I myself am a man. What we now call a cisgen man, as if it's something special. It just means that I identify as the sex I was born with. Is that so wrong? Why are we suddenly so preoccupied with transgender issues? The number of people who identify as transgender is slim. We freak because we can't put a name to it. We don't know what it is. We have people born women who identify as men, people born men who identify as women. We have pangender or asexual. We have people who keep male genitalia but consider themselves female. And the other way around. Plus, you have drag queens and other cross-dressers who just want to look good at the club and go to the bathroom, whatever they feel like. Get out of the way if you don't like it. And they are all lumped together with lesbians and gay men as part of the LGBTQ community. Community? What community is that? Is there a mayor? Is there a city hall? And what goes on behind closed doors there? And who does what? To whom? It used to be that all identity was owned by cisgen white males. We had the jobs, the houses, we had the cars, we had the direction, the values. We identified as American, which meant that any other identities were subsumed. If we were gay, we hid it. If we were black, we acted white. If we were Jewish, we changed the name to Johnson. But we did not identify as white. That was for Nazis, not to say we didn't have ethnic pride. Swedish associations, annual Lutefisk and Lefse fundraising dinners from the otherwise pride-free Norwegians. Identity became more of a hobby than a real thing. Folk dancing, parades, green beer on St. Patrick's Day. We could all be Irish, like being a furry or a drag queen, and identity was something we could put on and take off. But then the unappointed identity police began to object. Cultural appropriation. Dreadlocks are for black people, not white people with curly hair. Put down that bagpipe, sir, unless you are Scottish. And on the right, any expression of identity from black people was met with fear. When Beyonce had black male dancers wearing berets for her Super Bowl number, some freaked out that this was a coded reference to the Black Panthers, remember them? And she was calling for a race war in the time allotted before we got back to the football, I guess. In the wake of the policeman killed in Dallas, there is a call by some morons saying Black Lives Matter a terrorist organization. That's even dumber than the people who think Black Lives Matter is a slight to white people. White lives matter too, says the irritating white guy. And stay out of the ladies' room, men who say they're ladies. And the salsa's too hot. And the dye in the beer on St. Patrick's Day is made by Monsanto. Is there gluten in that lefse? You know when this all started? When the personal went political. What a bad idea that was. I feel solidarity up the wazoo, sure, but who's fixing the potholes? On the other hand, if you don't identify with identity politics, doesn't that mean that you identify as somebody who doesn't identify with identity politics? I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2016.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dave Millar is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Mark Stone, Erica Topete, and Ted Muldoon.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, local public radio, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Why are you always on about women, Stan?
I want to be one.
What?
I want to be a woman. From now on, I want you all to call me Loretta.